This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. With just two fingers, five strings, and a strong set of pipes, Wade Maynor forever changed the sound of old-time mountain music. Wade first experimented with the banjo as a kid in western North Carolina's mountains. He picked and plucked around with it so much that he eventually taught himself to play using only his thumb and index finger and created a rich and rhythmic sound.
First day of the year, old Reuben come up here, and she never had moved out since that day.
That's old Reuben, recorded by Wade Maynor in 1941. Wade's innovative style of banjo finger-picking led to the birth of bluegrass music, and it inspired the careers of music pioneers like Bill Monroe and living legends Doc Watson and Ralph Stanley, just to name a few. Wade Maynor is a living legend in his own right. The grandfather of bluegrass, as Wade was sometimes called, turns 104 years old today, so we decided to celebrate his life and contributions to music. Joining me by phone is Dick Spotswood. He is the host of the Dick Spotswood Show on WAMU's Bluegrass Country and the author of Banjo on the Mountain, Wade Maynor's First 100 Years. Dick, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you, Frank.
Great to have you here. Also with us by phone is musician and historian David Holt. David is a longtime friend of Wade Maynor and the host of Folkways, a program that you can see on UNC TV. David, welcome.
Great to be here, Frank.
Joining us in the studio, Sarah Bryan. Sarah is the editor of the Old Time Herald and program manager at North Carolina's Folklife Institute. Hello, Sarah. Good to have you here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
David, a lot of folks may not know the name Wade Maynor, but they are sure to have had some of the people that he influenced, Doc Watson, Earl Scruggs, we named a few others. Give us an idea of his significance in the history of bluegrass music.
Well, also in the history of old-time music, because Wade kind of kept the banjo before the public at a time when it was kind of fading out in the mid-30s, and sort of brought this really innovative two-finger style that really cut through on the records. So people could really hear that banjo. And it was the forerunner of what became the three-finger style. And so not only his great banjo playing, but his great singing and great song selection and, you know, some very good songwriting, Wade was a very influential in the old time and the bluegrass scene. And, you know, I was just talking to Doc Watson the other day about this. Wade Maynor came to the blind school where Doc was when Doc was 10 years old, and Wade Maynor came and performed, and Doc said he never forgot that, and it really influenced him from then on.
Wow. I mean, Doc Watson at 10.
Yeah, Doc Watson's 88 now.
By
so,
the man.
Here Wade is turning 104, so do the math there.
Do the math. Sarah, Wade is credited with bridging the gap between that old-time music that David was talking about, bluegrass. We're going to hear a lot of that. So for the untrained ear, would you explain for us the difference between those two, if there is one?
Between old-time and bluegrass music?
Bluegrass, yeah.
Well, they're actually a lot of differences, and I'd say even more similarities. They're both styles that are rooted in traditional Southern string music. I'd say much of bluegrass draws from old-time string band music, and they share a lot of tunes and songs, but though they would be played very differently. I mean, you'd recognize the difference in style. And I would say that bluegrass sort of springs from a performance and broadcast context originally, whereas old-time music came to that performance and broadcast context in time, but it had sort of come from the community-based music, square dances and playing in the parlor at home.
Maybe it's a kind of a style of play more than something inherent in the music itself. Dick Spotswood, Wade's early affinity for that old-time music shouldn't be surprising. He was born and raised near Weaverville, a city in the mountains of western North Carolina. Tell us how he came to play the banjo in the first place.
I'd like to add, just to remarks that have already been made, that I think it's even more important to consider bluegrass and old-time music adjuncts of the broader rubric country music. Mm. Sometimes they're not always approached that way, but I know Wade thinks of himself as a country musician first and foremost. Country music didn't exist until recordings and broadcasting made it possible in the early 1920s, and it was the first time that the old mountain string music was played for anything like profit or wide distribution or anything. Anyway, say your question again, Frank. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm glad for that. And I asked you how he came to play the banjo in the first place.
Well, he talks about having a brother-in-law, the fellow that married his older sister, Essie, and he was a fiddle player, and they'd play for some of the local dances and community events that Sarah was just describing. And Roy owned, I'm blanking on his last name, Roy Banks, I'm sorry, owned a banjo, and that banjo was the one that Wade sort of picked up and learned on at these dances. Wade insists that he taught himself. He never had any instruction or anything, and given the individual sound that he developed on the five-string banjo, I'm very much inclined to believe him. When I was down last fall at University of North Carolina, a distant relative of Wade, a great-great-nephew or something along those lines, actually has that banjo that Wade learned on and brought it to the book signing event that we did at University of North Carolina. It was quite a moment.
And what distinguishes these styles, claw hammer, two-finger, three-finger? What's the difference, and what is the difference in terms of the sound and the kind of music you're going to create?
I would defer to David on that, I think.
David?
I should run, get a banjo, and show you, but I'm not sure it would come across on the phone. But old-time clawhammer style is more of a loping style, duke, duck-a-duke, duck-a-duke, bum-diddy, bum-diddy type sound like that. It's the original style that came from Africa that came with a banjo-like instrument several hundred years ago. And the mountain people, white mountain people, black mountain people, all played that style. Then somewhere along the line, after the Civil War period, a picking style developed where people would use their fingers, and much of it was played sort of in a classical, what they call classical banjo style, and that influenced the mountain people too. So I don't think Wade really invented this in a vacuum, because I know people considerably older than Wade, I did know them, I mean they're long gone, but they were playing in a style similar to Wade's, but Wade just had a very distinctive role that he did with just two fingers. So it's not syncopated the way Earl Scruggs' three-finger bluegrass banjo sounds, and that's sort of the difference. The driving three-finger sound with that syncopated ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta, that's the sound that most people hear on the banjo today, but Wade had something in between those two, in between the clawhammer, which was a loping style, and the syncopated bluegrass style.
And he talked with you about that back in at the tender age of 98 when you interviewed him. Let's hear what he has to say about how he picked up that style.
Okay.
Now, I was interested in like the sound of the banjo, and so while they would play for a square dance, you know, sometimes it would go 45 minutes to an hour, and then they'd take a break for about 15, 20 minutes, and they'd lay the banjo down, and I was kind of interested in it as a young boy. I'd go over and pick it up, trail on it a little bit. I kept monkeying with it, and I started a little bit of clawhammer stuff. And it wasn't very long then till I done this on my banjo. Here's why.
Just pick the strings with your fingers.
I just picked the string. Huh. And that something hit me in my ear there when it sounded like that. I said, well, now that sounded a little better than, you know, that. I said, and that gave me a sound there that was different from clawhammer. So I kept fooling with it, till I got started with a two-finger banjo.
And nobody showed you how to
nobody,
do that?
No.
You just figured that out yourself?
Yeah.
Figured that out himself, and David, did anybody try to correct him along the way?
I don't think so. I think it'd be pretty hard to correct Wade. Right. About
he did say that he was trying to play an early three-finger style for a while, and that he was corrected by his older brother, the eminent fiddle player, J.E. Maynard. J.E. said Wade, essentially, that Wade was screwing up the rhythm when he played that way, so he wanted Wade to play that two-finger style, And that was the last that Wade and Three Finger ever coincided.
So he didn't mess with that a little bit. You talked about J.E., and he joined J.E.'s band, J.E.'s Mountaineers, in the early 1930s. Quickly,
well, it was a cooperative band, actually. It wasn't the first records had J.E.'s name on them.
I see.
But they were both using it as a device for getting out of working in the mills.
Yeah, which they did pretty successfully. Let's listen to a recording then, Maple on the Hill.
Near a quiet and country village grew a maple on the hill. Alone I sit in my reckoning along the stars were shining brightly, we could hear the wolf wail when we sat beneath the maple on the hill.
Maple on the Hill, we've got just about 30 seconds left in this segment. Sarah, did that kind of playing, do you think, did that stand out among the folks he was playing for? Certainly, if we heard this record around the country, mm-hmm. it would stand out as unique. What about local folks?
Well, I would say that in the area where he grew up, it was actually a kind of amazing hot spot for innovation in banjo playing, largely in the three-finger styles. Earl Scruggs is from Shelby. Mack Woolbright was an early recording artist who played in a three-finger style, and he was also from Cleveland County. And then Don Reno, Snuffy Jenkins, all those folks were growing up around there.
It's kind of a hotbed of innovation. Huh? Mm-hmm. We'll find out more about that, why that might be, as we celebrate today the birthday of Wade Maynor, 104 today. My guests are Sarah Bryan, editor of the Old Time Herald and program manager of the North Carolina Folklife Institute, musician and historian David Holt, and Dick Spotswood, author of Banjo on the Mountain, Wade Maynor's First 100 Years. Just ahead, we'll hear more about Wade's long hiatus from the music scene as he went to Michigan in search of his fortune. Find out how he came back. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned.
Who can pull this song, tell me it is I, and sing it all day long? It takes a weary man to sing a weary song. It takes a weary man to sing a weary song. Weary man, but I won't be weary long.
This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Wade Maynor was a huge influence on the development of bluegrass music. Wade had a hand in creating the modern bluegrass sound with his innovative two-finger style of playing banjo. The North Carolina native is known as the grandfather of bluegrass, and we're paying tribute to him today on his 104th birthday. My guests are Dick Spotswood, author of Banjo on the Mountain, Wade Maynor's First 100 Years. Sarah Bryan is the editor of the Old Time Herald. She's also program manager at the North Carolina Folklife Institute, and musician David Holt is a host of Folkways on UNC-TV. Sarah, just before the break, you were talking about the innovative style and the fact that this was a kind of a cauldron for that sort mm-hmm. of thing. Give us an idea of how much innovation and how many different kinds of music were growing out of North Carolina at that period.
Well, if we're looking at Western North Carolina specifically, there is that, you know, like we were talking about earlier, that cauldron of three-finger styles that were coming out of the area between Asheville and Charlotte, largely, and Wade, of course, with his two-finger style, which influenced those subsequent innovations. There was also going on at this time a really strong tradition of brother duets, as close country singing. In North Carolina, playing at the time, though they weren't North Carolinians, the Monroe brothers, Charlie and Bill, were at WBT in Charlotte.
Yeah.
The Dixon brothers, who were from Darlington, South Carolina, and they were also mill workers. And I would say that the Maynor band, the original configuration of it, also had a really big influence on brother duets, even though it wasn't the brothers singing. It wasn't J.E. and Wade singing mm-hmm. together. It was Wade and Zeke Morris, who was from Old Fort.
Of the Morris brothers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and Dick Spotswood, that, I mean, radio and recording was a really important part of that. We talk about influence. It was not about, you know, people playing at parties. The recording industry was big, and they were getting on radio stations, right?
Well, as I said a little earlier, this all happened overnight, literally, when country music first went on the air at WBT down, not WBT, I'm blanking on the call letters, down in Atlanta in 1922, and went on records for national, international distribution the following year. It became then less of a functional music and more of a performance music when it became country music, and Wade was and J.E. were out in front with that. They had to develop a show. They had to develop little plays that they would do on their shows, and they had to take counts at radio stations of where listeners were responding to things from various parts of the country. If they were advertising that they would send you a free autograph picture, they would count the postcards that would come in from this county, that county, mm-hmm. and so on. And all of this became a business, at not to the degree it is today in Nashville, certainly, but all of that has proceeded incrementally from the sort of primitive level it operated at that in those days. Because when you first started to be able to make money at it, it became it became an art form. It became something beyond community music.
And they, you know, Wade had to learn how to perform, and he was a great performer. All through his life, you know, he could do banjo tricks. He could play the banjo behind his back, under his leg, and all this kind of stuff, as well as being a good musician.
Yeah.
But he knew how to really sell something. In your book, Dick, you have a letter that WWNC, a radio station in Asheville, sent in 1941, where in 12 days, Wade received 8,619 pieces of mail,
wow,
requesting a picture. This was in addition to their normal 3,000 pieces of mail they got a month. So they would, you know, they would go out to these little schools and perform in the evening, and then rush back to get to do their morning show. It was a grueling thing.
But we have to understand.
They had to do these shows at 5 and 5:30 in the morning because they would broadcast to the farmers while they were eating breakfast, after they'd milked the cows and were coming back to eat breakfast before they set out to do the daily plowing, and that was the optimum time to capture them. So every one of those country radio stations throughout the Southeast would have live music by some poor hillbilly band that had to stay up all night to make the show at 5 in the morning.
Because they were on the road. Selling, of all things, crazy water crystals, which was a fancy name for a laxative.
Yes.
Right? Well, so that was a good time to sell that too, I suppose. But here's the thing that we have to keep in mind, Dick. These are AM radio stations in the mountains, meaning, I think, they didn't reach very far. So isn't that true? I mean, each radio station itself didn't have a huge reach, or did it?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that WWNC phenomenon, because that map is reproduced in the book, and it does show that they were getting mail all the way from both Carolinas into Virginia, into Kentucky, and into West Virginia, and they were doing quite well. It depended on the station. It depended upon the power that the FCC would allow them to have. Mm-hmm. And, of course, if you were broadcasting at 5 and 5:30 in the morning, you were broadcasting before sunrise, and your signal would carry that much
That's
further.
Right. Yeah, that much. So not only did this advance Wade's professional career, but also his romantic career. His love life was improved when he met a DJ. David?
That's right. Well, they met during radio. His wife was called Hillbilly Lily in those days, and she would come in from time to time from her farm in Moxville to perform, you know, every once or twice a month or something. It wasn't on a regular basis. It was when her father had to come to town for something. And I believe I was at WBT.
I think she was at W. She was in the station in Winston-Salem. What is it, WSJS or something?
Yes, that's right. Thank you. And Wade was there. They met, and she decided to have the Mainers come out and play a surprise party for her father's birthday. And apparently that's when things got serious.
I remember him telling the story about that. He said they pulled up. Now, I thought he hadn't met her before this, that she had hired him. Her father was a fan. She knew about him, and anyway, she hired the band, and he said when the car pulled up into the house and he saw her and pulled up in the driveway and saw her, he said, "She's mine. I'm going to marry her." And he did.
And we have no idea how many times he'd said that in the past, but anyway, this time it took. Right. Her name is Julia, and she's with him today.
She is. She's the backbone of the family.
I want you to know she is 93 years old this year. She still drives the car and pays the bills. And those folks live in the house that they have lived in, since they had a fire in 97. but they have lived independently ever since they moved to Flint in 1953 and still do.
I want to get a sense of the recording industry, Sarah. Maybe you can paint a picture for us in the 1930s and 40s. Mm-hmm. What was that like?
It was that's such a broad question. I'll try to break it down.
Sure.
It was closely tied in with the radio market. Bands would play a certain radio market, sell their records at their shows, or, you know, people would come to furniture stores or wherever they bought their records at the time. And then they would move on to the next territory. They would sort of play out an area.
So it's mostly localized, was it?
Well,
or not?
The records would be distributed much farther than this range, but the way it affected the musicians' own performance schedules was that they'd sort of play out an area, then move on to next station. You've been in Charlotte at WBT, now we'll go to Raleigh, and, you know.
They would have kind of a little circuit. They'd stay for like 6 months or a year maybe sometimes, and like you say, do every gig possible, play every song they know 100 times, and then they got to move on. You know?
Played every schoolhouse stage.
Right. That was radio the way we always imagined it, right? The band was really at the station.
The band was at the station.
And for these guys, it was. And David Wade recorded mainly on a label called Bluebird. Where was Bluebird based, and how did he get signed in the first place?
I don't know. Do you know that, Dick?
Yes, Fisher Henley was another remarkable banjo player, and who's the guy that owned the banjo that Wade coveted. Mm-hmm. He went and bought another version of Fisher's banjo. Fisher's banjo wound up in it's Earl Scruggs' banjo today, and Wade's banjo just sold for a little under $120,000. Mm-hmm. Very rare model Gibson Granada RB. You would know better than I, David, but the banjos were very critical to that sound that they were getting on the radio, and I'm sorry. Now you asked something else.
Where was Bluebird, and how did he get signed? How did
Fisher decided that they sounded good, and he had already recorded for the label, and so when Eli Oberstein had a recording session scheduled. In those days, the record companies would jump from one southern city to another, recording local and regional talent. The Mainers went down to Nashville and met him and the RCA recording team there. The records were published on the Bluebird label, which retailed for 35 cents, mm-hmm. while other Victor records were going for 50 cents, you know, reflecting the state of rural economics in those days. And that was Wade's label. He did hundreds of sides for that label up through World War II.
But do I understand you to say they were going around the country trying to capture various sorts of Americana, in other words?
The record companies were doing that. They would record Bill Boyd's Cowboy Ramblers in San Antonio. They would record Wade Maynor and the Blue Sky Boys and the Dixon Brothers in Charlotte. And they would record Red Nickel and His Five Pennies in New York.
And then would they sell them nationally, or would they only be sold regionally? Was the idea to get a national audience for music you might not have heard in New York? Or
emphasis would be regional, but occasionally, like if you had a song like Maple on the Hill, that would break nationally. And in Wade's case, he was also discovered, I use the word advisedly, by Alan Lomax in 1940-41, and Alan arranged to have Wade come up to play a concert, Wade and the band, for a little private concert for FDR and Eleanor Roosevelt in February of 1941. He still has the letter of invitation from Archibald MacLeish, who was the poet laureate at the time and the Librarian of Congress. And Wade has gone to dinner many times off of a wonderful story. He got hit in the back by a door when he was holding a plate of ice cream, and it spilled down the front of Eleanor's dress. he said, you know, they were wearing their overall outfit and everything. Wade reached in a big red kerchief to try and wipe Eleanor down, and she said, no, you need to do that. And he said, and 5 minutes later, she was back with a brand new dress.
And so he's playing for the president by 1942. This would be President Franklin Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. And I understand that he got a request, and it was for this song. Let's listen. Mm-hmm.
love did mean. Where we said according, my love dropped off to sleep.
Down in the Willow Gardens, by then, Sons of the Mountaineers. Wade was playing in that band, was that right? And he got that request from Franklin Roosevelt.
It's a pretty gruesome request to come from the president.
Yeah, that kind of a sad song. That's a
murder ballad. Yeah,
ends badly. Huh?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's one of many, many old time songs, pre country songs, really, where you know a pregnant girl gets murdered rather than married,
yeah.
And people like to write songs about things like that. Go figure.
And apparently, listen.
We should mention the Chisholm Trail that he was on, because mm-hmm. that was a kind of a big deal too. Aside from meeting Roosevelt. There was a BBC broadcast in New York in 1944, and he was on this show with Burl Ives and Lily Mae Ledford and Woody Guthrie and Cisco Houston, some of those folks, and that mm-hmm. was always something very memorable to him.
So here's a man enjoying fabulous success. He gets to spill ice cream on the First Lady, and but he chucks it all. He went to Michigan. He's worked in the mills, worked for GM. Tell us that story and why he left music.
He had a couple of really serious reversals. One was a photo essay that was to feature him and the Carter family that was going to run in Life magazine in December of 1941, and the story was canceled when we went to war. That was the first thing that happened, and shortly after, maybe even slightly, but really right around the same time, he had a telegram, and he still has a copy of the telegram from the solemn old judge at the Grand Ole Opry, George D. Hay, inviting Wade to come and play on the Opry. Wade was under contract to Lowell Blanchard at WROL in Knoxville, and Lowell would not let him out of the contract. And one can only imagine how history might have been rewritten if Wade's band with that banjo had gotten to mm-hmm. the Grand Ole Opry mm-hmm. in 1941 instead of Bill Monroe's band with that other banjo mm-hmm. in 1945 with Earl Scruggs. I think the landscape might appear very differently today. But because of wartime rationing of gasoline and tires, and you couldn't even buy new cars, he basically had very, very few performing opportunities. He went back to farming and played music when he could, and his career never really recovered from all of that. And when he had a chance to work on the assembly line in Flint, Michigan for General Motors in 1953, he took the job because it was a steady income. His family by that time included five children. He put the banjo in the case and put the case under the bed and told absolutely nobody that he had had a career as a performer. Hmm.
And there was just no market for traditional music at that point. By the 50s, you know, the folk revival hadn't started really, and he just couldn't make a living doing it. He wanted to, but he couldn't.
He could have, but it would have taken a sophistication and a business connection that he would have had if he had been in Nashville, but he didn't have when he was in Mocksville.
Well, right.
I understand, too, that religion played a part in this or some part in that. Is that right?
When he went to live in Michigan, he was also traveling, playing music before he started to GM with a traveling evangelist. And yes, he was born again.
If I can jump in before the question of his religion and the music, I'd like to say also that his move to Michigan was part of a really huge migration that was going on at the time of people from the Southern Mountains in need of work, going to Detroit and Flint, where the Mainers settled.
But he didn't have a sense anywhere, Dick or David, that he felt once he was born again, music was not an appropriate thing for him to be doing?
I don't think he felt like he should play secular music. Yeah. He just would play gospel music.
Molly O'Day kind of talked him out of that, because mm-hmm. Molly, the same thing had happened. She was a very prominent country musician and a banjo player, and she had had a similar conversion from a near-death experience, and she is the one who persuaded Wade to play music again. She said to him, essentially, if the Lord gave you that gift, then you're really not doing the right thing if you're not making the appropriate use of it, and that convinced him. And by the time he retired, he would play folk songs, simple folk songs, and he would play the old songs he'd done. I mean, they had never done sexually suggestive material. They had never done honky-tonk songs or cheating songs and everything. And a lot of the songs that they did do, were well within the confines of Southern Protestant Pentecostal respectability. So it really wasn't ever that big a transition in any direction.
We talked about his influence on contemporaries. David, how would you characterize his influence on the music today? Is he still heard among younger musicians?
Yeah, I think people listen to Wade and get ideas. There's actually quite a resurgence of two fingers style picking today, where it was, I'd say, you know, some years ago it was mostly in claw hammer or three finger style, but and I think that's partly because of Wade's really strong picking. And I think anybody who gets into traditional mountain music is going to come across Wade Maynard, and you got to spend some time listening to those, not only the banjo playing, but the really great harmony singing that he had. Wade, not only was Wade's banjo something that cut through on a, you know, a old-timey recorder, but his voice also was very strong and would you could really hear it on those old records. And he would usually have a harmony singer like, Red Wilson was one of his harmony singers, and he could, you know, just hit that strident tone that was just really coming through on the 78s and on the radio.
You know, David, I've only got about 10 seconds left, but give us an idea how Wade's doing today at 104.
Well, he's doing okay. He's alive, and you know, Julie's taking good care of him. But he is 104, so he's quite forgetful and not playing much music. But he was playing music right up until, you know, till quite recently.
That touring schedule has slowed down a bit, but he's 104 years old. I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. David Holt, musician, historian, also the host of Folkways on UNC-TV. Sarah Bryan's the editor of the Old Time Herald and program manager of the North Carolina Folklife Institute. Dick Spotswood is the author of Banjo on the Mountain, Wade Maynard's First 100 Years. He also hosts the Dick Spotswood Show on WAMU in Washington, D.C. Thank you all for being
on
the program.
Thank you.
Today is Wade Maynard's 104th birthday, and we wish him another great year. Coming up, a Chapel Hill chef shares her secrets for seasonal cooking. Stay with us on The State of Things.
Sit down.